Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Suicide is a tragedy that leaves a legacy of sorrow, pain, and confusion. With over a million people each year dying of suicide, it accounts for more deaths than all the casualties of homicide and war combined. On average, one person dies by suicide every 40 seconds somewhere in the world, and one person every 12 minutes in the U.S. Over the last 10 years, suicide rates have increased 20%, and suicide is now the fourth leading cause of death in the United States for people ages 16 to 64. One of the real tragedies about suicide is that many of these deaths could have been prevented with proper education, training, and targeted intervention approaches that help people recognize the signs and risk factors associated with suicide. Joining us today to discuss suicide prevention is American Foundation for Suicide Prevention board member Kim Hancox. Kim joined the Alaska chapter for AFSP as a volunteer and board member in 2013. The Alaska chapter was created to raise awareness, offer support, fund research, and advance prevention for the problem of suicide in Alaska. Kim was a nurse for 17 years, has her master's degree in business administration, and is currently the administrator for the Alaska Center for Ear, Nose, and Throat. Kim also serves on the board of trustees for Alaska Regional Hospital. Kim, I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thanks so much, Prentice. Happy to be here.
Need to take a moment to remind our listeners how we can be reached. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or reach us on our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. And you can always email us your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. If this is your first time emailing, you have to spell that out. That's L-I-N-E-O-N-E. Please don't hesitate to call in. Your calls make the show a little bit more interesting and add a different flavor to it than just Kim and I here talking. So don't be shy. I guess let's start out, Kim, with tell us a little bit about your role with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
Sure. Thanks, Prentice. So my role as board member for AFSP here in Alaska is to support our board chair, Dennis Lasley, and the other board members across the state. There are eight of us across the state. And we work together. We're grassroots volunteers. We don't get compensated. We work really, really hard together to help bring the national organization home to the people of Alaska. We focus on community outreach, education, and research.
Okay, now Dennis was at one point going to join us, but he had to, unfortunately, he had to, it is Dennis, right?
Dennis,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, he had to bail out, so it left you as the sole voice for them. Well, how'd you get, I mean, why suicide prevention? There's lots of things to volunteer for. There's lots of causes out there that are certainly worthwhile, and people are volunteering all over the community. But so why suicide prevention for you? What is it that is important about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, honestly, when I went to nursing school 17 years ago, we talked a little bit, you learned a little bit about suicide. And, you know, to be very honest, it really wasn't on my radar. Like many of us in the community, it's not something that you really want to talk about. It's not something that you talk about at dinner or at cocktail parties. And it wasn't until March of 2013 when my son's best friend, Hannah Williamson, who's a sophomore at Eagle River High School, died by suicide. Hannah was this amazing, very well-loved teenager, straight-A student, on track for the Air Force Academy, and we didn't pick up on the signs as a group, as you know, the people that surrounded her. And so when we lost Hannah, it sent us all into a tailspin. She was the first suicide that happened at Eagle River. And for a period of time, I was lost. My son, I didn't know how to help him. I didn't know how to help the ROTC cadets. There were lots of support from military chaplains and things like that, but I didn't know what was out there. And so through the magic of Google, I was able to reach out to AFSP here in Alaska and to Dennis and got connected that way and realized, you know, we need to come together as a community to fight, break down the stigma. There are wonderful charities out there to do volunteer work for, certainly. But for suicide, I think we don't put enough attention to it when we need to. And so that's why I'm working really hard and focusing on that. It's my passion.
I think you brought up a really important word, and that's stigma. And when it comes to suicide, there is a big stigma about that. As you said, it's not something people talk about. Parents often, you know, don't. I mean, I remember talking to parents whose kids have died by suicide, and they, I mean, it's a tough thing to say. Mm-hmm. Your child was so unhappy that they committed suicide, and I don't know. It's a tragedy. It leaves people confused. It leaves people asking themselves many, many questions. I remember a friend of mine, not a great friend, just an acquaintance at school, at a small school. He died by suicide his junior year of high school. And I remember asking myself, like, oh, he should have called me, but I never talked to the kid outside of school. And why would he call me? But you just start asking all those questions and wondering what was missed and what happened. So I appreciate the work you guys are doing over there. So what's we mentioned, I guess, the mission of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, but the Alaska chapter, a little bit more detail on what they do day in, day out, and where they're reaching out, who they're talking to and what they're doing exactly.
Yeah. So one of our board members, Jim Bila, is a social worker, and he spends every single day of his life out in the villages. So in Bethel and North, going to villages and educating people there. We have board members in Fairbanks that reach out. We're trying to pull people in using programs like Talk Saves Lives to go out into organizations and really make suicide a word that we can share and not have an immediate kind of knee-jerk reaction. We spend a lot of time doing community events. We have some walks coming up here in April and May, and we do a party for prevention in September. But a lot of the work that we do is kind of behind the scenes in preparation for these events that essentially four times a year. So trying to educate the community, working together with other organizations, and just reaching out and having volunteers join us. And sometimes it's as simple as just having a conversation at Starbucks or talking to the person in line next to you at Fred Meyer about, suicide. We sometimes wear sweatshirts that say Be the Voice, which is the tagline for our national group. And, you know, it's interesting when you're standing in line just next to perfect strangers, they'll, you know, strike up a conversation. Oh, Be the Voice. What does that mean? And so you kind of open up into conversation and dialogue about, you know, suicide. And at first, people just don't want to talk about it, but they're curious. Especially when you start talking to more people, you realize, oh, man, there are so many people affected. It's honestly, it's hard to find people that haven't been affected in one way or another. Maybe they know someone or a family friend. But the more that we talk, the more we learn about it and break down the wall, like we said, about being comfortable to talk about depression, anxiety, and suicide.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point that there isn't anybody that I know. I would challenge anybody to find someone who hasn't been affected by suicide. It's kind of the same with addiction or substance abuse. Mm-hmm. Find somebody who hasn't been impacted by that. And,
right. You
know, either if it's not in your family directly, it certainly has touched you with one of your children's friends or a friend of yours. I think the more we talk about it, the better. So speaking of community events, am I correct in that May is suicide awareness month or suicide prevention?
There's a lot of annual
awareness.
Suicide prevention month is in September.
It's
the second week in September. And typically, the national chapters, all the other states, do their walks towards the fall. But because the weather is so fabulous in Alaska, we have special permission to do our walks in April and May. So it kind of feels like it should be suicide awareness.
There's a lot happening.
Yeah. So we tend to, we like every day to be suicide prevention awareness.
All right. So speak to some of the things that people can get involved in if they want to get out and support the cause and raise awareness for this.
Yeah, I'd love to. So it's walk season starting up. So this Saturday, we will be up in Fairbanks at Griffin Park. Beginning at 11 o'clock, we have our Out of the Darkness walk there, which is an incredible event. People get together that are, you know, lost survivors come together. We have memorial gardens. People can bring photos of those friends or loved ones that they've lost to suicide. It's an amazing time for people just to come together and remember. We do a bead ceremony that's representative of who you've lost. And so that's a great event. That's this Saturday in Fairbanks. And then May 7th in Mat-Su, we'll be doing a walk in Palmer at the Downtown Pavilion beginning at 11 o'clock in the morning. And then May 21st, we're back here in our old stomping ground here in Anchorage at the Delaney Park Strip on the West End, beginning at 10 o'clock. So the walks are very similar, but we get out to different parts of the state to do that. And then in September, we'll be doing Party for Prevention. So that's to be announced, the location and what will be involved there. But it's important to note, I try to encourage people to come to the walks. It's free of charge. There's no registration fee. You can bring your dogs. They're pet friendly. It's just an amazing time to be together as a community, raising money for such an important cause.
Okay, before we get into more of the content here, I need to take just a moment to remind people that who might be tuning in late that my guest today is American Foundation for Suicide Prevention Board member Kim Hancox. The focus of today's show is suicide prevention. Please remember you can reach us with your questions or comments at our local phone number. That's 550-8433. And you can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752 or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. So if you if you've been touched by suicide, if you have a story about suicide, if you have a comment or a question for Kim or myself, please don't hesitate to call in and we'll get you on the air. Okay, so let's get into suicide rates. And I was, tell us a little bit about the Talk Saves Lives program. What is that?
Yeah, I'd love to. Talk Saves Lives is a national program that was introduced for those of us at the state level to bring back to our hometowns. It's a community outreach resource that gives an introduction about suicide prevention. So I go out to groups and different organizations here in Anchorage and give a 45-minute interview, if you will, a program that covers the general scope of suicide. We learn things about the research on prevention and what people can do, what we can do as a community to help fight suicide. People that come will learn the risks and warning signs of suicide, and it just opens up really great dialogue among people that, you know, about a topic that we tend to not talk about.
I think talk, the name kind of says it all. Talk saves lives. I mean, speaking about something, bringing it into the light, shedding some of the veil of mystery and stigma that you mentioned. All right, we got our first call. I'd like to go ahead and take Jim. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I don't know if this is within the scope of your discussion. It sounds like you're coming in on a different vector, but with states in the U.S. now regulating assisted suicide and having been affected by suicide directly and indirectly, I recently had a loved one who was suffering terrible effects of disease, painful disease, and at some point in the palliative care, it came to light that this person could have probably spared some of the less desirable part of passing by having that option. And I think that dialogue is valuable to open up, and I'll just leave it with that.
Thank you very much for the call, Jim. I think that's a great point. People's right to die with dignity, and that's a debate that's going on. And in fact, it's interesting you brought that up, because that is on my queue as something to have on as a topic for Line One. I think it'd be a great discussion, and I know it's being had all over the country. Kim, do you guys have any connections with any of that?
You know, at the national level, AFSP at this point doesn't really have a talking point to assisted suicide right now.
Right.
Certainly, it's something that's being discussed and truly important. I, as a nurse, having worked palliative care many, many years ago, I certainly understand and respect those people. It's a very personal decision but it's a tough thing to talk about. So I think there's more to watch here about this particular topic, and certainly something we should be discussing.
My grandfather and namesake died of Alzheimer's disease, and it was he was in excellent health, so it took a really long time. And the last couple of years, really, he was not with us. And, you know, I think we learned some lessons from him during his time when he was, you know, he taught even though he couldn't really communicate and didn't know who we were or where he was. But I don't know. I go back and forth on that. I mean, we learned some valuable things, and it brought our family closer together and taught me. I was 18 years old when I took care of him for 4 months. And, you know, but the last couple of years of his were really painful to watch. So I certainly respect the call and the thought, Jim. I appreciate it, and I'll hopefully we'll have a conversation about that soon. So suicide rates are up across all groups. Can you discuss some of the statistics about suicide and some of the theories? I mean, it's been the last 10 years, I guess, things, they were going down for a while, trends were going down, and then they suddenly started to sort of eke back up. Can you talk about some of these statistics and what are some of the theories on why it's going up?
Yeah, absolutely. There was a study that was actually just published towards the end of last week from the CDC and the National Institute of Health that was frankly alarming, I think, to many of us. And yes, to your point, from 1986 to 1999, we saw a steady decline in the rate of suicide. And unfortunately, from 1999 forward, there has been a great increase, despite all the work that we are trying to do. So in 1999, 10.5 of every 100,000 people died by suicide. And in 2014, they noted that number has increased to 24%. So 13 out of every 100,000 people die by suicide. That's more than twice as many people that have died from Parkinson's disease or homicide per year. And as you mentioned before, ages 16 to 64, the number jumps to the fourth leading cause of death in the United States. If you had a chance to read that article, Jeffrey Bornstein, who's the president of the Brain and Behavior Research Foundation, was actually quoted in that article. And I found this really, really compelling. He said, "It really should be a call to action. If it were any other cause of death, it certainly would be a call to action, and it would be on the front page of every newspaper." And I think he's exactly right. We should be talking about this. It should be on the front page of every newspaper. The new results that were collected by the National Center for Health Statistics at the CDC, they were just focusing on cause of death by death certificates. But what was intriguing about this was that they show that men are more than three times more likely to die by suicide than women. The men at highest risk, and this was really new information for us too, that it's really increased in the in people ages over 75. So we're seeing the geriatric population becoming greater risk for suicide. And the second most at-risk group were men between the ages of 45 and 64. That suicide rate increased 43%. And while we know that suicide, unfortunately, remains a mostly male problem, we're seeing that gender gap narrow. So the suicide rate that this particular study noted in women increased by 45%. Again, same, we're noticing that those women over 75 were at greatest risk, as well as middle-aged women. For me personally, the most alarming, aside from those statistics, was that the National Institute of Health noted that the biggest increase in girls were actually between the ages of 10 and 14, and that rate increased by 200%, which just, that was startling to me, 10 to 14. And so to answer your other question, you know, why? Why is this happening? And, you know, unfortunately, the data doesn't offer many answers. We know the statistics, but we don't really understand why this is happening. Researchers say that the access to firearms and, of course, abuse of addictive medications and drugs like opioids could be a potential factor. You know, I'm sure you're aware there are white papers out suggesting that there might be an increase in suicide rate and social media.
What's a white paper for folks that aren't aware?
Sorry.
Sorry.
So white papers are professional articles that are written by scientists, researchers.
Okay.
Simply just a scholarly article. So, you know, there are some people who suggest that with the rate in which our teenagers and our children are using social media, and we're highly wired, if you will, they have access to YouTube and things like that, that there may be, we don't know for certain, but there may be a connection there too. So, but the bottom line here, it's frustrating that we don't know the answers. And it's partly because the research only began about 10 years ago in suicide prevention. You know, we've been studying vaccines and diseases for decades, but we've only started looking at suicide within the last 10 years. So we've got a lot of work to do
in
that area.
It's incredibly is underfunded a fair statement for something that is the 10th leading cause of death and the fourth leading for 16 to 64 year olds, which is really the prime time of the lifespan. So fair to say it's underfunded?
Absolutely. Without question, it's underfunded. You and I both love statistics, so I have a couple more for you. So HIV over the last 10 years has been given $2.9 billion with B, and we've seen a 53% decrease in death, which is remarkable and wonderful. Heart disease, $1.2 billion. And we've seen a decrease in the rate of deaths by 29%. Even prostate cancer appreciated $266 million, and we've seen a 13% decline in deaths, which is wonderful. Unfortunately, suicide over that same time span has only received $37 million, with an M, not a B, dollars. And we've seen an alarming increase in deaths by 20% now. So certainly we've made major progress in these other diseases and we've seen decreased mortality rates. But I think the time is now to start funding more research for suicide so that we can understand it at a completely different level and hopefully work together to prevent it.
History supports the fact that if we tackle something head on and we fund it and we research it and we target it for interventions and for strategies to understand it better and then to apply that understanding to solutions, that we have the capability, whether it be underage drinking, smoking, cancer, HIV, we have the ability to really make a dent in those numbers. And suicide, I would think, is not much different. I guess it goes along with mental health funding and addiction funding. And I mean, those are the major causes of suicide, which obviously I guess we want to get into those right away and talk a little bit about what should people know about the risk factors that make people vulnerable to suicide. Could you speak to that for a minute?
Absolutely. Certainly, risk factors are very, very important to understand. But I want to just bring the point home again at the enormity of the problem. I think it's worth noting again. Suicide isn't just an Alaska problem or United States problem, but it's a global problem. As you mentioned, it affects more than a million people a year. And what we haven't mentioned was that 22% of the people that we lose in our country per year are military and veterans.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I always like to make that point because I think it's important. But with regard to risk factors, they are grouped into three categories. And these risk factors can collide at different times in our lives and increase a person's risk for suicidal behavior. So the first risk factor that we look at are health factors. They include biological and psychological aspects of one's health, including medical. As you mentioned, the most significant of these are mental health conditions. 9 out of 10 people who die by suicide have a mental health problem actively contributing at the time of their death. And of course, depression, we understand, is by far the most common mental health condition and the one that we see most as a risk factor for suicide. So detecting the presence of a mental health condition is critically important. The best way to be sure, of course, is to seek a professional evaluation and effective treatment when you feel concerned that you or your loved one could be at risk. And so the second risk factor that we look at are environmental factors, or said another way, things that happen in a person or a family's past history. So we understand that there are often layers of a person's environment that can contribute to their overall level of risk. So access to lethal means, which includes firearms, drugs, things like that, certainly put someone at a higher risk. A contagion, including exposure to another person's suicide, sometimes we don't really think about that. So, emergency workers, police officers certainly can be at a risk that.
Kids who have a friend who commits suicide,
absolutely.
That's a super high risk time
mm-hmm.
for adolescents. We just recently had one in a local high school here, and people are pretty concerned about some of those kids that were close to him. I want to get back to risk factors in just a minute, but we're at the halfway point of our show, so let's go ahead and we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. My guest today is American Foundation for Suicide Prevention board member Kim Hancox. The focus for today's show is suicide prevention. You can reach us at 550-8433 or call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us your questions or comments to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Kim Hancox. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is American Foundation for Suicide Prevention board member Kim Hancox. The focus of today's show is suicide prevention. As always, you can email your questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or reach us on our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, the show repeats tonight at 8 p.m., so if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you will be hearing a taped recording, and we will not be able to accept phone calls, obviously. All right, we're going to get back to our discussion about risk factors, but before we do that, we have a caller. Keith, you're on line one. Welcome.
Was that me?
Yes, Keith.
Is okay. What I have to say is not anything new. I'm sure your guest there has plenty of information on this, but I want to emphasize I've been there a few times, and I have friends who've committed suicide. I'm going through some stuff right now that if things don't get better, it's going to be awful depressing real fast. No matter how bad it seems at the moment or today, just keep walking through the crap. One step at a time, keep walking through the crap. It will get better. One way or another, it will get better. But if you do something awfully permanent right now for a temporary problem, you're never going to see the other side of it. You're never going to see anything get better. You have to just keep not doing stupid things and keep moving forward. And I wish I had a more positive way of putting that. But that's the bottom line. No matter how hopeless it seems, just keep walking through and get to the other side. Don't give up hope. Have faith in God and don't give up hope.
All right, Keith. I appreciate the call. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I don't think, Keith, you could have said it any better. You know, I heard somebody say, keep stumbling forward when you find yourself down. And there's lots of ways to look at that, but you're right. Suffering is often and usually temporary if you work hard. And a mentor of mine likes to remind me that joy is also quite temporary, so don't get too attached to it. No matter how you're feeling, it's bound to change. And I think that's the message from Keith. Kim?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. It reminds me of the quote, you know, when the going gets tough, just keep going.
Right.
Yeah, very, very good words, Keith. Thank you so much for that.
Okay, back to, I think we're at number two, risk factors. Can you talk a little bit more about risk factors that make people vulnerable?
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked about health factors and environmental factors being contributors, and finally, historical factors. So those things include past events like a family history of suicide or a family history of mental health conditions, and even past trauma such as sexual abuse or combat stress. And while most people who attempt suicide don't go on to die by suicide, we certainly look at previous suicide attempts as putting a person at greater risk for suicide.
Okay, so folks that have mental health conditions, substance abuse, history of trauma, I mean, all these things are, history of trauma, substance abuse are all mental health conditions that contribute to loneliness. But what makes somebody, I guess, more vulnerable to suicide, then, I mean, a lot of people go through that stuff and never think about committing suicide, or I guess you like to point out to me, committing suicide is not a good way to say it. Can you speak real briefly to that? You corrected
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely. I did correct you. Dennis will be proud of me because he's had to correct me too. We tend to like to say died by suicide. People who commit crimes are criminals. And people who unfortunately die by suicide are not criminals. They're not committing an act. It's a personal choice. So we say died by suicide. It's just another way that people lose their lives.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. I think that's an important distinction because the language that we use around this stuff is important. So what makes somebody more vulnerable to suicide than other people who maybe have more resiliency? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, absolutely. So it's interesting to point out that one in four Americans at some point in their life will experience a mental health condition, whether it be depression or anxiety. And those people don't go on to die by suicide. So why do some and die and some don't? So we understand that when these three risk factors kind of come together in a perfect storm, that's when people are the most vulnerable. So there may be a genetic factor. There may be a family history. There might be an environmental stressor, like someone's just lost their job or they're drinking more than usual. So when all of these things come together in this sort of perfect storm, and people have this just incredible physical or emotional pain, that's when people become more vulnerable. They start to have irrational thinking. And it's hard to, when you're in the middle of that, it's hard to see anything else. I tend to, when I'm talking to people about suicide, I say, you know, think about a time in your life that you've had the most pain you can remember. You know, 10 out of 10 on a pain scale from a nursing perspective. And you can't, when you're in that much pain, you can't think of anything other than that pain. And someone who is in an acute critical phase, who are, they're having suicidal ideations, that tends to be their perspective. They just can't see outside of that. So, you know, it's tough. But that's why we have to, you know, be available and be supportive and seek out, especially mental health treatment, and access for people so that we can, get the help that people need at those crucial times.
I've heard people say that suicide is selfish and such a selfish act. And my response to them is always that, like, we have no idea. If you've never been there, how much pain that is emotionally. And it's not a rational process, is it? I mean, I don't think normally it's somebody who's really thinking things through. It's just this unbearable suffering that they just want to end. I've heard people describe it as, I don't really want to kill myself. I just want to, I like to go to sleep for like 10 years because it's just so quiet,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's, I think, what people don't understand about suicide is that it's not selfish. It's not designed to hurt people typically. Maybe some of those impulsive lashing out ones are designed to hurt, but usually it's people who are really struggling and really suffering and been that way for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Having talked to people who have attempted, I try to learn the perspective, what was it like at those particular moments? And, the selfish point of view, like you brought up, it's you're right. It's not that. In fact, people most of the time look at it as selfless. They feel like they're such a burden,
mm-hmm.
and they're such a pain to other people around them. They feel like their families would just be happier if they weren't there. And so, yeah, on the contrary, I don't think it's selfish. I think it's selfless. And it goes back to that sort of irrational thinking that plays into that and the impulsivity. But, it's not rational thinking. Certainly, we love our friends and our family. We don't want that.
Okay, if you're just tuning in, my guest today is American Foundation for Suicide Prevention board member Kim Hancox. Our focus for today's show is suicide prevention. You can call us with your questions or comments at 550-8433 or reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way to participate is by emailing a question or a comment to line1@alaskapublic.org. Are the signs different? I mean, we talked a little bit about teen suicide, and one of the things that I often think about with teen suicide is this idea you mentioned, social media and bullying, but this sense of isolation that people feel. It seems like suicide is something that happens to people who feel really, really alone and isolated often. Because as human beings, we need connection to survive. We need depth of relationships, and we need, you know, that sort of human contact and feel like we're being seen. But kids seem to sometimes get really isolated and feel like nobody likes them. And I have, you know, I don't have any evidence to back it up, but I feel like a lot of these things we see on teenagers who commit suicide from cyberbullying and stuff like that is really about that kind of sense of loneliness and despair. And I'm an outcast, a pariah, and I'm never going to have any friends. It's never going to change. So are the signs different for teenagers than for adults? What should parents be aware of if they're concerned about their child?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And we tend to see that the warning signs are very similar in teenagers as they are for adults. Some of the things that we need to be really paying attention to are talking, mood, and behavior. When you are seeing your teenager or your friend or your loved one start to have a change in the way that they talk about things. So they might be talking more about, you know, life not being worth living, or things would be better if I weren't here. You know, just listen to your gut. We tend to not listen to our gut enough, I think. And when that, you know, you kind of pick up on things just being a little bit different, pay attention. So verbally, things may sound different. They might be posting on social media different things too, you know, especially with teenagers who are seemingly connected all of the time to social media. They care very much what the rest of the world thinks about them, and so they pay attention to that a lot. But posting things starts to look a little bit different. Mood changes, and this is a tough one, especially with teenagers, because teenagers, you know, we've been
normal,
teenagers, right?
That's normal.
Teenagers are supposed to be moody, right? That's a teenager. It's the definition of a teenager. But when they start pulling away in a different way or isolating themselves, much like you said, that's when we really need to be concerned. Now, of course, they can have bad days, just like we do. As adults, but it's when those bad days turn into bad weeks and longer periods between, you know, Joey seemingly moody and then okay, that's when we need to be really paying attention and in tune. And look, it's hard. Teenagers are tough animals. Having two of them myself, it's really hard.
I have one teenager who was talking about suicidal thoughts, and she said, well, I wouldn't do anything at least for 2 weeks because I got a play that I'm going to be in like in a couple weeks. So I had less concern for that because she's still engaged. She's still looking forward. And when young people stop looking forward and stop engaging in activities and their friends, you know, sort of disappear and they isolate more and more, I think those are really telling signs. And then another a young person who did attempt suicide, fortunately was unsuccessful, was liking a lot of things about suicide on social media. Really, I like this, I like that, and pain and suffering and darkness.
Dark.
And just really reading about that all the time and fueling that sort of negative thinking and despair and isolation. So that's something I think parents should be aware of. I want to go to I've had a caller on hold here for quite a few minutes, so I want to go to Jeanette. You're on the air.
Hi. I just had a couple of comments to make, and then I'll take my response off the air. I've been a nurse for many, many years, decades actually, and when I went into nursing, the prevailing wisdom was that if somebody tells you they're going to commit suicide, they aren't going to do it. The only people who don't tell you do it. And obviously, that is not true. And it's been one of the things that, you know, I've learned over this whole time of nursing, and that people who are going to commit suicide do it. Some of them don't, but they probably don't tell people about anything in their lives, let alone this. You know what I mean? And so it's really important to know that you can't put people in a group because they do act one way or another way. And the other thing is that it's really important that we take the threats seriously. I think that sometimes, you know, like you were just saying, the person said, oh, I didn't mean that because I have to do this in 2 weeks. You're probably right in that source. But, you know, really, people say it because they want to see what the reactions of other people around them are. And they want to be protected. And so I think it's really important that we really listen to people who are threatening suicide. And that's all I wanted.
Thank you very much, Jeanette, for the call. Those are good points. Kim, you got a response or reaction?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, Jeanette, thank you for your diligent work as a nurse. It is, I think, one of the most important jobs in the world. And so I thank you for your tireless work. I would also like to just kind of dovetail on what you said about taking the threat seriously. Certainly, people, yes, want to see what your reaction is going to be if they say something like that. But it's important to really pay attention to that, you know, and to also feel comfortable saying the word suicide. I've had teenagers in front of me and adults in front of me, and I've said, you know, are you thinking about suicide? It sounds like you might be having some suicidal thoughts. And it's interesting the reaction that you get. Because then you kind of break that wall down and they say, maybe they say, yes, actually. And then you now have the arena to have open dialogue where before they were maybe closed off. So, it's contrary to popular belief. You can say the word suicide and nothing bad happens. And on the contrary, something good might.
So there's a couple of things that the call made me think of, and one is those young people or older people that talk about suicide all the time. You know, somebody breaks up with them, I'm going to kill myself, and they do a lot of that attention-seeking stuff, and, you know, over and over, 10, 15, 20 times a year, people are telling people that they're going to kill themselves, and it seems a lot like attention-seeking stuff. How do you address that? You can't take them to Prov Psych ER every time they say, I don't want to be here anymore. I'm just going to kill myself. So how do people respond to family members or those? Because I had a foster home, and the kid that I had in my home, or one of them, would say that all the time. I'll just kill myself, and he'd scream it. And you're supposed to respond as a foster care provider by taking them to Psych ER for evaluation. But after like the 20th time of going to the psych ER and spending 4 hours there and then, you know, leaving. How do you address that with folks?
Yeah, that's a challenge. And it certainly does happen. You know, it probably happens more frequently than we're aware of. But I think the best way to navigate that is, you know, at least when they're saying it, they're talking to you. And you have the ability to continue the conversation. You know, okay, I hear what you're saying. You know, let's talk about that. Certainly, it's beyond my scope of practice to be able to say, you know, well, if they've said it 10 times, then perhaps they don't, you know, certainly don't take them to Prov. I can't say that. But certainly, you know, I would say the positive there is that they're still talking and giving you the opportunity to talk back. And you know, anytime somebody starts having those kinds of thoughts, we need to be able to intervene with some sort of professional help, whether it's a social worker or a counselor or a chaplain, getting them connected and really sitting around the table and saying, you know, this is how that makes me feel when you've said that 10 times in a week, you know, and just starting that dialogue.
I tell folks it's super important to look at the behavior. For people who threaten it a lot, are they still engaged in school? Is it sort of a temporary down where when they get really down, they act out and say things for attention, but they're also still doing okay in school? And so, like you mentioned, all those other risk factors like withdrawal and isolation and despair mm-hmm. and loneliness for long periods of time. I think that's when people become really vulnerable to suicide. Now, teenagers are a little bit different. They're especially vulnerable for suicide, and I think a lot of that has to do with impulsivity and the frontal lobe and their lack of reasoning. I got an email here that is a really good email. I just want to read real quickly. It said, I recall hearing someone say a long time ago that suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. I was a depressed teenager at the time. Many years later, I'm glad I heard those words. So can you speak to teen suicide and why that's especially worrisome?
Absolutely. So I think having been a teenager, you can also, relate that it's probably one of the most challenging times in our lives. That period of time, you know, from 13 to 18, we are expected to perform highly academically and participate in extracurricular activities still while maintaining these new relationships and, you know, boyfriends and girlfriends and all of this and just the general pressure of life. You know, you have to raise your hand to use the bathroom, but yet tomorrow when I graduate, I'm supposed to know what I want to do with the rest of my life, right? It's tough. It's probably one of the most challenging. And yet, you know, kids are the most vulnerable because they are they don't have the life experience that you and I have. So we know that today could be a really, really bad day, but yet tomorrow could be better. So we understand the so-called roller coaster of life, if you will. You know, today could be really bad, but we're going to get through it. And, you know, brighter days are to come. And teenagers, they tend to not have that life experience. And so they can't see outside of that. And so, you know, they tend to, yes, make a permanent decision for a temporary problem. And I think that, you know, that's probably one of the main reasons that they're the most vulnerable. And it just has to do with brain development, of course, the frontal lobe, and life experience and lack thereof.
Is it fair to say that many teen suicides are sort of impulsive, decisions or actions based on emotional pain?
You know, I don't know statistically if we have the data to back that up, but I could certainly say anecdotally that yes, you know, it's you know, life trauma that's happening to them, maybe parents' divorce or a loss of a loved one, coupled with all of these other stressors that we've talked about.
When I was 16 and my girlfriend broke up with me, I thought I was going to die. I didn't necessarily want to die by suicide, but I didn't think I could live anymore. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was permanent. I'd never love again, which turns out to be untrue. But it seems so intense, and our emotions are so raw and so new, and you don't understand them. And teenage depression and
hormones.
You know, good friend of mine, a therapist, says keep them alive till they're 25, and then they have a really good chance of being okay. So what do you do if you're concerned that somebody, how do you talk to somebody who you think may be suicidal, but they're not talking to you about it, and you have some concerns as a family or a friend? What do you do?
Well, like we said, talk saves lives. And so you have to open up that dialogue, you know, sit down with them and feel okay saying, you know, are you having thoughts of suicide? Are you depressed? And that's truthfully a really hard thing to say. But, you know, say it and pay attention to their body language. Pay attention to how they react. You can glean a lot from that. And just start that connection. And then, you know, if you know, keeping that conversation going, maybe if they're not ready to talk yet, maybe you write a letter to them, or unfortunately, text. but somehow formulate communication so that they know that they're loved and that they're supported and that you're there, and hopefully they'll respond.
And for kids, if your friend tells you they're going to kill themselves, I just want to leave this with folks. You got to tell an adult. You got to tell a parent, a
Absolutely.
Teacher, somebody. Don't be worried about your friend being mad at you, because it's better mad at you than not around. So we're up against the clock. Can you give us something to kind of take home for our listening audience, something you want people to remember about suicide prevention?
Absolutely. I would say first and foremost, suicide is not a bad word. We need to start being more comfortable talking about it, understanding it. And I would love for people to come out and get connected in our community walks that are happening. They can learn more about that at afsp.org/Alaska. And I would hopefully we can start to work together as a community to break down the stigma of suicide and depression as a group.
Educate yourself about the warning signs, the symptoms. Get online. We have some great links on the link to the show that you can check out. Okay, thank you, Kim, for being here today. I really appreciate the information. It was great having you.
Thanks. It was great being here.
Please remember to check out the variety of links and information we have available on today's topic. Just go to alaskapublic.org and click on the link to today's show. If you would like to continue the conversation, you can join us on Facebook. You can find that link on our website. It's alaskapublic.org. And please share your thoughts or comments about today's show. Well, three relatively common viral infections of the liver sound very familiar in name, but in fact are quite different in their communicability, complications, prevention, and treatment. Hepatitis A, B, and C will be the topic on the next Line 1 Your Health Connection. So why not tune into Your Health and learn more Monday, May 2nd at 2 p.m., repeating at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1 Alaska Public Media. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Thanks for taking the time to join us today on Line 1. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.